Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, April 18th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Now, you may notice that throughout this week's podcast, there is a little bit of an audio issue, a little bit of a hum. I'm still trying to troubleshoot that. I've tried buying new XLR cables, not working amazingly. But I do have an entirely new rig on its way to me right now, which includes great studio mics, new cables, new boom stands, everything that you could possibly want. And all of that was made possible by the support of those of you who listen to the podcast, those of you who rate and review, and especially those of you who support the podcast financially. As you know, Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download. It is my intention to always, always keep it that way. And I really do appreciate the support of those of you who are, you know, in a position to do so. You know that you can visit the website, carasantamaria.com, and click through to the PayPal portal to make a one-time supportive donation. Or, as many of you do, you can visit the show at patreon.com/talknerdy. So I want to give a shout out to those of you who are supporting the show in a really major way this week. I want to thank Phil T-Bear. I want to thank Timothy Glover. I want to thank Jafe. Sorry for pronouncing that wrong last week. I called you Jaff. That's terrible. I think it's Jafe. I want to thank the Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but definitely not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart. And not only do I thank you, but all of the other listeners do as well. Now, please don't let any of the audio issues get in the way of enjoying this week's incredible podcast. I have to say, I was absolutely honored to be able to spend some time this week with Dr. Neil Shubin. Now, you may know him if you've seen the PBS special, Your Inner Fish, or if you've read either of his two popular science books, Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body, or his newer book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Plants, and People. I was so excited to be able to sit down with Neil while he was visiting Los Angeles that I brought mini nerd Stella along for the ride. You guys probably remember her from a few podcast episodes ago, and you may hear her a little bit in the background while we're chatting on the podcast. Now, I had limited time with Neil, so do not fret and do not worry. He has already promised to come back for a take two. So we will have Neil back on the podcast very, very soon. But in the meantime, I really do hope you enjoy our chat. He is a multi-talented scientist. He's a paleontologist, an evolutionary biologist, an anatomist, and of course, a science popularizer. He's also the Robert Bensley Distinguished Service Professor and Associate Dean of Biological Sciences at the University of Chicago. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Neil Shubin. Well, Neil, thank you so much for sitting down with me here in beautiful Irvine. And you are here to, I know the face, right? You are here for a symposium.
I am here for the National Academy of Sciences Symposium on Gene Regulation and Evolution.
Nice. And so evolution has become as a discipline, as a focus, much more complicated than it was back in Darwin's day, hasn't it? I mean, in Darwin's day, trying to bust myths and break things open about how the natural world came to be, and in essence, without even wanting to, pushing against the kind of common religious understanding, it was tough. But Darwin didn't even know about genes.
Yeah, that's the whole beautiful thing about it. I mean, here's Darwin over 150 years ago coming up with a theory that makes sense of something he didn't even know about at the time, the genome. I mean, discoveries that are happening every day in the laboratory are telling us about how evolution works and how genes can control evolution. It's really remarkable. So in a way, you know, yes, evolution's got a lot more complex, but the theory has gotten ever more powerful, you know, and that's a truly remarkable insight, and I just love it.
It is really cool that it seems like every single new piece of evidence just continues to converge into that one and just to further support the theory. And in many ways, the exact way that Darwin laid it out, you know, that natural selection is the way that evolution occurs, that there are these natural pressures, and those pressures don't have any sort of interest. They're not guided in the sense that we think of them. These are just mutations. These are mutations that occur naturally, and based on how the climate, based on, you know, any sort of changes that are existing in that part of the world are putting pressures on these organisms, their fitness is either there or it's not.
You know, and the piece that really blows my mind is that there's a tree of life, and that tree of life is knowable. That is, you and I, we can look at our DNA and we can determine how closely related we are to one another. And we can use that technique to look at other people and build a tree of our cousins. But then we can extend that to the rest of life on our planet, you know, from worms to fish to microbes to viruses. I mean, that we see a tree of life that includes all these species. I mean, that's totally mind-blowing, you know, and that's kind of insight that I pinch myself every day, that we can know something about, that I can know the genome, or I can go out and find fossils, and I can infer things that happened hundreds of millions of years ago. I mean, come on, that's cool.
And you can do so much of that by looking at the genome of organisms that are alive right now, by looking at your own genome.
Yeah, so what we do in my lab, we do both find fossils up in the Arctic and elsewhere, and we also work on genes in the laboratory. But yeah, you know, if I look at the genomes that build, say, the skeleton of a fin of a fish, and then I look at the genome that builds the skeleton of, say, a mouse or a human, I can look to see what's similar and different. What are the differences between a fish and a person? It's really remarkable. And then we can begin to understand how, at the genetic level, did this transformation from a fish fin to a limb with fingers and toes, how did that happen genetically? And geez, then I can go out to the fossil record, I can go up to the Arctic this summer like we're doing, and find fossils, you know, fish with arms, to actually see how it happened. You know, and to be able to do both those things in this scientific environment, that's so powerful. It's hard to overstate just how exciting it is.
So do you think that it would be safe to say that we have more in common with species that are wildly different than we are? Let's say, I don't know, a banana. Do I have more in common with a banana than I have not in common with a banana?
At the genetic level, there's quite a bit in common with the banana, yes. Avocado, too, which is, you know, it's also reassuring.
I prefer a banana.
I'm a guacamole guy.
You're a guac guy, yeah. I was born and raised in Texas. I'm a queso girl. I've never been that into the guac. So I want to talk a little bit about what got you into this field. So for those who don't know, even though I will have already introduced this, I'm time traveling a little because I will have introduced you on the podcast. You, I think, as a communicator of science, as a public science figure, many people might know you from Your Inner Fish, whether it be the book or the wonderful special that you did on PBS, or series, I should say.
It's a 3-part miniseries.
There you go. Those who maybe haven't seen Your Inner Fish don't know that probably the line, if somebody were to Google you, that they would see first would be discoverer of Tiktaalik. So let us know first who Tiktaalik was, and what sort of led you into asking the kinds of questions that eventually led to that discovery.
Okay, so where this all began was actually about 45 years ago. I began as a science nerd, okay? Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to be a scientist. Actually, I wanted to originally be an astronomer. Then I decided I want to be a geologist. And then I said, no, I want to be a veterinarian. So all that, just throw that in the mix. But cut to the chase many years later, if I was to hold Tiktaalik in front of you right now, you know, what you would see is a creature that looks like a fish, has mm-hmm. scales in its back and fins with fin webbing, has the armor and texture of a fish in its head and elsewhere. But like a limbed animal, it has a flat head with eyes on top. It has a neck. No fish has a neck. And when you look inside that fin, what do you see? You see a shoulder, an elbow, even parts of a wrist. One bone, two bones, little bones. The bones that we see that make up our arm have equivalents in this fish. So Tiktaalik is a sort of an evolutionary intermediate between life in water and life on land. It has lungs and gills. It has fins that have limb bones inside. And what makes it even better is the way we found it. We spent 8 years in the Arctic looking for this critter, using the theory of evolution to make a prediction that it would be up there. So, you know, we designed an expedition to find this creature, spent a number of years looking for it, not so successfully, but then ended up in 2006. Hitting the jackpot.
I love that. I love that this wasn't a random happenstance. It just so happened to fit into the theory. But this was something much like the Higgs boson, or I should say the Higgs field, where scientists knew it existed. It made perfect sense with the theory that it would be out there. I mean, you don't ever really know until you have the evidence in front of you, but there was a very good chance that this existed. So once it was finally discovered, it was exciting and it was earth-shattering, but it wasn't that surprising, was it?
That's right. The fossil itself is not hugely surprising. And neither are the tools we use to find it. But it's just so unbelievably gratifying that we can use a theory that Darwin designed over 150 years ago to find new fossils. I mean, it really reveals how science is a predictive framework.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you put that all together. The piece of science communication that really gives me passion is discovery. Is how we go about exploring and finding new stuff. You know, because every day a scientist wakes up, you know, venturing into the unknown. That's just, you know, and it may be the unknown in a test tube, on a gel, in a computer, or in the rocks up in the Arctic. But that's essentially what the Enterprise is, and that's fundamentally a human enterprise because we're an exploring species.
It's so true. And so, do you think that people kind of equate Tiktaalik and Tiktaalik's place in this tree of life with, for example, I will point to my arm, Archaeopteryx? Do you think that it really serves as an overused term, but something of a transitional species or like a missing link species?
Oh, sure. It shows how the transition from life in water to life in land happened. It shows us which characters came first, you know, in what context, in what environmental context. It shows us how these different creatures at this part of the tree of life are related. But there's something more, a lot more. Because we can trace the bones of Tiktaalik to the Archaeopteryx on your arm, but even better, we can trace the bones of the Tiktaalik to the bones inside your arm. And that's really what's powerful. It's the evidence that we can use to connect fish to people. We can see that in the fossil record. I can trace those fossils, you know, from fish to amphibians to things we call reptiles to mammals to primates to people. But even better, I can trace the genes and developmental processes that build them. So we can pull together all this evidence to show just how we're related to fish like Tiktaalik. And you know what? That's just the tip of the iceberg. I could take it back even further, you know, to flies and worms and others. And that realization that this transition from life in water to life on land is not some just, you know, esoteric, crazy branch in the tree of life. I mean, it's something that's inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
That realization is so profound, you know, and, you know, that every time you bend your wrists, every time you shake your head, you know, you could thank Tiktaalik and its evolutionary cousins living 375 million years ago. What? That's so wild, you know? I mean, I love that. And for me, that became a real piece of science communication to get the word out.
Do you think that it's really important that we, and I shouldn't say start, because I think within the scientific community, we've been doing this for quite some time, but that the general public at least start to understand that when we graphically represent evolution and when we talk about all of the organisms that are alive today and all of the organisms that ever existed that we have evidence to support, that it really is represented as that tree with all of these terminal branches, all of these false starts and stops. Because I think that sometimes the public gets a confused understanding of how evolution works. And they think that certain things are connected in ways that maybe they're not connected because of the graphical representations that we've had in the past.
I think that's stymied us to some extent because you usually see in human evolution the transition from like a monkey to some proto-human all the way up to a human. It's this like linear ladder of evolution. And we know that's not how evolution works. You know, it's a tree of life with thousands, if not millions, of species. And each of these things is a terminal branch. And what we do in evolution is we try to understand our relationships as cousins, you know? And sometimes we can infer ancestors. So this the way we look at evolution is very different from the popular conception. And it's actually in some ways way more powerful because we can use those ideas of a tree of life and then deploy them to the geological record and make predictions about where to find the next fossils. That's cool, okay? Because that's the predictive element. That's why I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm a scientist about to find the next stuff. That's what always interests me. I mean, the minute we found Tiktaalik, I was like, okay, where are we going next? I'm like, let's get out of here, you know. And I've been working on Tiktaalik for a few years, but now we're on a whole new thing. So, yeah.
And so, how many of those species, those kind of predicted ancestors that we know exist but haven't yet found based on looking at the relationships between us and our cousins. How many of those really are out there?
Oh, I'm sure the world's full of them. I mean, like, they have to be. You know, I mean, I wake every morning thinking, wow, what's there still to discover? You know, the earliest vertebrates, the earliest creatures with backbones, some of the earliest animals, all these things, I think we have a whole universe to discover. Mm-hmm. And the reason we can do it now is we're getting better. And we're getting better because the technology is improving. We can scan inside rocks with CT scanners. We know more about the geological record now. I mean, every day we go ahead, we learn more, and we can deploy that new knowledge to find new stuff. And so we as paleontologists, we as molecular biologists, we're better than we were 25 years ago. And here's one statistic. I mean, if you look at some of the most significant transitional fossils ever discovered, most of them have been discovered in the last 20 years.
20 years?
Yeah, maybe 25.
That's right? Great.
We human think evolution, whale evolution, bird feathered dinosaurs, whales with legs, fish with arms, you know, hominid ancestors. Just think about that for a second. You know, people have thought that story's over. It's not at all. And in fact, every few months you read mm-hmm. about some new discovery. And there's a reason for that. We get better. We know more. We learn. And one of the consequences of learning is being able to find more stuff.
Do you consider yourself a paleontologist, a geneticist, an evolutionist, a molecular biologist? Do you wear all of those hats?
Yeah, the answer is yes. The thing is, people who know me know that I am very hyperactive, that I get bored very quickly, mm-hmm. That I have lots of passions. And so my lab is it's not chaos, but we do a lot of different things. So I would describe myself as an evolutionary biologist. I'm interested in the question, how do the great steps in evolution happen? Well, you know, if that's your question, you have lots of tools. Tool number one is go out and find new fossils. Tool number two is look at development. Tool number three is look at DNA. Tool number four is, you know, look at how the structures work. It's all there for you, right? And there's all evidence is good evidence if you know how to use it and find it. And that's what my lab does.
Does it depress you that you can't look at Tiktaalik's DNA directly?
Yes.
Really?
It bums me out.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But you can infer many things about Tiktaalik's DNA based on even our own DNA.
Oh, a ton. I can look at our DNA and I can compare it to various fish and I can tell you what genes are likely there and what genes are likely not, how they likely work. Yeah, so we can infer it. But it would be cool to have it. My lab just worked on a project with a bunch of other labs on the genome of coelacanth, mm-hmm. you know, and we worked on the genome of gar. So we got to see living fossils. That was fun. Genome of, quote, living fossils.
Yeah.
That was fun. And we learned all kinds of cool stuff.
Do you think that's a misnomer when people call them living fossils, or do you actually like that term?
No, I hate that term, so I just used it.
Yeah, he did air quotes when he said it, by the way. You can't see that.
Yeah, it's a terrible term. But, you know, it's kind of the popular thing. You can't get away from it entirely. But, you know, some of the things we did, for instance, we took some of the genome sequences of a coelacanth mm-hmm. and put them in a mouse to see if they worked in a mouse and to see if they worked during development. And guess what? They do. We did the same thing with the gar. We made a mouse that had gar genes inside or coelacanth genes inside. And we were able to test, you know, how the genome of the gar or the coelacanth works in the mouse context.
Wow.
Guess what? It works just fine.
And it's not that it actually told the mouse to do fish-like things. It told the mouse to do mouse-like things that were analogous to the fish.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it did it in limb development, too. So we're able to see where in the development of... So we're able to take a gene that's active during the formation of a fin mm-hmm. of the coelacanth or a fin of the gar, and we put it in the genome of a mouse to see is it acting in the right way during the development of the limb. And guess what? Yeah. And then part of the take-home message there is a number of the genetic sequences that mice and people use when our fingers develop, mm-hmm. they're present in fish, even though they don't have fingers.
Even though they don't have fingers.
And they're present during the development of certain regions, the terminal end of the fish fin. So how cool is that, right?
So this was for those listeners who are actually probably more biology nerds, maybe you're in college right now, maybe this is something that you like to read on your own. Are we specifically referring to the group of genes known as the homeobox genes, like these kind of body segmentation genes?
Yeah, so we're looking at Hox genes, homeobox genes, mm-hmm. That's some of them, but we look at a lot of other genes. These are genes that are sort of active in development. Mm-hmm. So homeobox genes are a very famous group of those genes. And we're looking at the control sequences for those genes, the so-called regulatory elements.
So those tell it whether or not to express.
Yeah, where and when.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I know that, and I didn't actually say this at the beginning of the podcast, but I should have. Stella, who was my guest maybe 5-6 episodes ago, something like that, is joining us today. She's sitting next to me enjoying this conversation.
With the world's best t-shirt, I should say, by the way, even though they can't hear it. She has a TikTok t-shirt.
It's pretty amazing, actually. We should tweet the t-shirt. I think we should. And she actually attended your talk last night. And she, in the car, we were talking about the talk and about what we were talking about. And she said, I wish we could have talked more about Hawks jeans. Do you remember? Do you have any specific questions about Hawks jeans that you wanted to know? If so, make sure you put your mouth up to the microphone. Uh-huh. If we get there. Okay. So yeah, maybe we'll dive a little bit deeper into this phenomenon, what these genes do and why they're so important for your research.
Well, let's just step back a bit. So mm-hmm. we know from work on mice that these genes are active in the formation of major parts of the body. So in the limb, for instance, let's just use that as an example. There are several of these genes. They're on several different chromosomes and they work together. But what they do is they're active during the formation of different compartments of our appendage. So you hold your arm out, right? And you feel like there's one compartment, your upper arm, there's the middle compartment, which is your forearm, and then there's this other compartment, which is the wrist and fingers. Those three separate compartments. Turns out the homeobox genes, along with a lot of other genes, are active in defining those compartment boundaries, right? So those three regions. So if you engineer a mouse that lacks particular Hox genes, you can have a mouse that lacks the wrist and digits. If you engineer a mouse that lacks other ones, you'll have a mouse that lacks the elbow all the way out to the digits. So it's pretty. And if you follow what cells are active, you know, that have turned these genes on, the cell lineage corresponds to that as well. So these, at several different levels, the homeobox genes are active during the formation of these compartments.
And so when we see people, I mean, I'm assuming that we've all met a human being, for example, who is missing a certain compartment of their arm. Maybe somebody who seems like they don't have an upper arm and it's almost like their forearm is growing out of their shoulder, or they just have hands but they don't have arms. Is this often caused by a mutation in those genes?
It can be, yeah. And you can have finger anomalies too. It's not the only one. There are lots mm-hmm. of genetic reasons for that, these kinds of things, but it's certainly one big one. Anyway, so the obvious question to ask is, okay, what are these genes doing in fish, right?
Yeah.
You know, where
they don't
are these
have arms.
There you go. And so that sort of motivated it. And so work on mice really showed where the regulatory or control sequences are, and my lab found them in fish. And then what we did is we did the knockouts in fish. We turned the genes off. We followed the cells. And it turns out that the wrist and fingers of our arm, of our hand or feet, correspond to the terminal end of a fish fin, which contains the fin rays. You know, it's really surprising. I mean, that there's an equivalence among those. And that's something that the DNA points us to. And here's the major lesson. The lesson is when you follow the trail of DNA, it sometimes gives you surprises that you wouldn't have predicted just from knowing the anatomy, you know, and that's why it's good to have both the DNA evidence as well as the fossil evidence.
So do fish then, if the kind of wrist and hand equivalent is like that terminal part of the fin, do they then have the forearm and upper arm equivalent?
They have an equivalent, yeah. It's and they have bones that are formed in cartilage that sit there too. So the take home message is that, you know, fish have a, you know, the mice and fish are very closely sort of tied at the genetic level, even though the adult structures are very different.
And so when you actually look into the genome, things that maybe before you didn't know what they did, or, you know, why do they have these genes that don't seem to be expressed, when you start turning them on, turning them off, expressing them, or changing their expression, you actually do see these analogous structures, just like you see in mammals. Does that apply even to organisms that we think of as, quote, lower-level organisms? I mean,
you can find these genes in flies.
In flies.
Versions in flies. Yeah,
flies are probably the most famous example, right? I know most biology students, when they're learning about homeobox genes, learn about it in fruit flies.
It's all flies all the time.
Yeah.
Well, they're a great, you know, organism in some ways to work on, right?
Oh, Drosophila.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What about worms?
Worms are great, too, even better mm-hmm. in some ways for a lot of things, because you get zillions of them, and you know where every cell ends up, and there's so many breakthroughs. I mean, there have been, what, five Nobel Prizes or two Nobel Prizes to five people in the last 9 years. And just
on
C. elegans? On C. elegans, yeah, a tiny nice. Little worm the size of a comma on a piece of paper. That's pretty mind-blowing.
And so worms do have bodies, and they have body segmentation, but they obviously don't have hands.
Yeah.
Are they straight missing those kinds of genes?
Well, you know, so if you look at, you know, hundreds of millions of years of evolution, these genes have changed. In some groups, they have multiple pairs of them. Others have lost numbers of them. So there's been some jiggering around with these. But it really was work on flies and mice and looking at the tie between these genes and flies and mice that sort of opened this whole question up.
It is interesting when we think about where we are. You know, I think as human beings, we're the ones who are sitting here podcasting about this. We're the ones who are sort of able to recognize ourselves in the mirror, able to reflect on our own place in the universe, able to do the kinds of experiments that you do in the lab. And because of that, I think we often put ourselves in a sort of special position, you know, that may be hubris in many ways. But in doing so, I think it's so humbling to remember exactly what evolutionary quirks and what random mutations, what, you know, both positive and neutral mutations ultimately led to this complex body shape that we have, to these complex features that we have. Understanding our place in that tree of life, in that genetic kind of milieu, really does help us understand all the other organisms under the sun, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. I mean, it's you know, knowing the tree of life and our relatedness to other creatures is deeply humbling, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, you know, you think about it. I mean, just how connected we are to flies and fish and mice. But also you think about how many breakthroughs, medical breakthroughs, are originally based on flies and fish and mice. It's both humbling and amazing.
That's,
you know,
true.
That so much of understanding ourselves has come from understanding other creatures. But, you know, just think about when you know your own family tree. You know a lot about your own biology, so you know what diseases your parents had and grandparents had and cousins have. You can make predictions about your likely susceptibility to conditions and so forth. Well, it's the same kind of conceptual thing when you know your family tree with other animals. You know much more about your own basic biology, how your chromosomes work and other things like that. So it's very powerful knowing the past.
It makes me wonder, you know, we often have a hard time thinking about big numbers because in many ways, evolution really does feed into psychology. And we think about the fact that we walk around on Earth and a day is 24 hours and a year is 365 days. And certain things that we think about all the time are based on sort of the restraints of our lives. So I know what 20 years feels like. I have no idea what 10,000 years feels like. It just is hard for me to comprehend. Our common human ancestor was over 200,000 years ago, right? We think of modern humans as occurring around then. But our common, I don't even know what you would call it, fish ancestor, yeah, amphibian ancestor, let's say Tiktaalik, it is a common ancestor with humans and many other organisms. How long ago was
almost
that?
Almost 400 million years old. So
400 yeah, million
and
years
so
ago.
And you know, you think about it, I do this all the time, honestly. So I'll be like up in the Arctic, like where I'll be this summer, cracking rocks. And it's cold, it's snowing, it's windy. There are muskox in the distance, the occasional polar bear ambling by. It's snowy with, you know, glaciers all over the place. And I'm cracking in the rocks. And the world inside the rocks, it's a tropical rainforest, right?
Yeah.
With tropical plants, tropical fish. You know, think about that juxtaposition between present and past. And it sort of crystallizes in your brain when you're a geologist because you learn to see inside the history inside rocks. And you start to see these juxtapositions. Well, in the same conceptual way, when you're an evolutionary biologist, we see inside our own bodies. I mean, I can see when I look at you, you're kind of a bipedal fish to me in some ways. I'm a little weird, but it's true. You begin to see the ties in many ways, and you begin to see the basic body plan, our basic architecture is really established first in fish, and you see those fundamentals. It does change how you see the world, just like being a geologist changes the way you see the natural world, the rock world.
And of course, we don't exactly know how life first came to be. We don't fully understand the spark. There are some great experiments out there where, you know, certain amino acids are in a soup and then there's lightning and then that could have sparked, you know, these early proteins to build up to produce organisms. But beyond that, our finger is not on that yet. But we do have a pretty good understanding that life did start in the oceans, correct?
Yeah, most definitely. And it probably got a pretty rapid start and maybe multiple starts. It may be that having, you know, my early life is easy to come about, you know, and that conscious life is really difficult. It took, you know, billions of years. But it may be that just having replicating life maybe the bar may be low if you have water and the right, you know, the right Goldilocks conditions. I mean, who knows? But it's all real speculation. But we do know that life came about very early in the history of the planet. And it took a very long time, billions of years, for bodies to come about. And then only, you know, after bodies, another 600 million years for, you know, humans to come about. I mean, so think about that for a second. You know, how an exponential change in complexity has really, you know, the rate of change has increased exponentially in evolution.
I love that you said bodies. It's one of those things that sounds so unscientific, but it is so scientific.
But it's like so precise.
There's a difference between something that doesn't have a body and something that does.
Yeah, exactly. You got a single cell, and then you got a body.
Yeah. No, it's so true. And this is why I think it's so exciting to many astrobiologists that soon, hopefully, NASA will be able to allow us to go to Europa. And soon we'll be, oh, thanks, Stella. Stella brought us water. That's so nice. That soon we could potentially visit Europa, and Europa could have these, you know, these maybe early organisms. They might not have bodies.
Or Enceladus, you know.
Or Enceladus, yeah, even. Exactly. They might not have bodies. Maybe they do. Maybe they have very simple bodies. Maybe they don't exist at all. It'll be hard for us to be able to tell, because we won't even really know what they would look like, but we would assume it would follow some of the similar rules that we see here on Earth.
Just living in an age, think about this for a second, where our senses, through mechanical devices, extend to the bottom of the ocean and extend past Pluto. Hello. I mean, you think about
that. It's insane.
We're seeing, you know, deep horizons. We're seeing Pluto and beyond. You know, the
Voyager,
which is still chugging along.
Like leaving the heliopause.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and now missions to the solar system, the gas giants and the moons. I mean, that we are able to learn about these things, that blows my mind. I mean, I look at that NASA site, you know, today on Mars, pretty frequently. It's pretty amazing.
It's so cool. Yeah, the fact that we're getting like literally almost minute-to-minute updates of what's going on Mars as if it's down the street from us.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's incredible.
Like a, it's like a webcam, you know.
So we have to cut this a little bit short because, of course, you are very much an in-demand scientist, and there are a lot of great things happening here at the Sackler Colloquium. But before we do, I want to end the podcast with the same two questions. I would be really remiss if I didn't ask you before you went. I close every episode asking everybody the same two questions. The first one's a bit of a bummer, so we'll do that one first. And that's, when you look to the future, in whatever context matters to you, whether it's personal or like a global context, what is the thing that worries you the most, that keeps you up the most at night? You know, the thing that you're most concerned with. And then on the flip side of that, what is the thing that, that you're most excited and optimistic about?
Well, on the downside, just begin with the downer. We live in an age where a small and infinitesimal fraction of humanity can pretty much wipe a lot of us out. So we live in an age where it's increasingly dangerous because of the tools we have in a small number. Most of us are wonderful people, but a very small fraction of us can do an inordinate amount of damage. So I wonder about humanity in that way. Also, as you probably hear a lot, you worry about the planet and as a consequence of that as well. What am I most optimistic about? I have a longer list of things there. I wouldn't be a scientist if I didn't in many ways. You know, I just the rate of the wave which we've known about the genome and are able to understand the genome, unlocking not only understanding our evolution but disease. We are living in a true revolution in science, in our understanding of the genetic mechanisms that build bodies, that drive basic processes in biology. The technologies that we use in my lab today, some of them weren't even around 2-3 years ago, yet they're all game changers.
Wow.
And we're in an age where new technology comes about, say, every 8 months that sort of can antiquate experiments you started, you know, 7 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, and the pace of change is bewildering, but I think we're going to feel the impact of that in our lives, and certainly Stella will probably more in hers, in just so many different ways.
It's so true. When Stella's doing research in the lab in the next few years, she's going to be doing things that not only didn't exist, but felt like a pipe dream back when I was in the lab. Yeah, it's insane.
And so when technology not only gets more powerful, but has a way of becoming more democratic, becoming more accessible. And I think I'm an optimist about both those things, and that may countervail my original pessimistic quote.
I have to agree, and I think the maker movement is a testament to that. Seeing how many people have been able to tinker in their own garages or tinker in makerspaces and build phenomenal machines and make things from scratch that only the richest of the rich and big institutions could do before. It's really humbling and impressive to see that happening. Well, Neil, I have to thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Before we go, let everybody know, you know, how they can follow your work, both as a scientist, but more as a science communicator, you know, other than going to the PBS app, which is where you can find your inner fish. I know it's still on the app. It's my favorite app on Apple TV. Yeah. Oh my gosh, you guys, it's so good. And of course, you have two books, right?
Universe Within and Inner Fish. Yeah, and you can follow my Twitter feed. I'm always tweeting about goofy stuff and science and Inner Fish and Universe Within. Follow my Facebook posts and so forth.
And that's all just at Neil Shubin.
Yeah, exactly. Not
very
hidden.
Easy. Cool. Well, Neil, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.